cake with darker blue icing that read, "Congratulations, Percy the Graduate." I did not ask why graduate was misspelled, dyslexia being so common in demigod families. "Then," I gulped, "he's not here." It was a silly thing to say, but some stubborn part of me insisted that Percy Jackson must be here somewhere, waiting to do dangerous tasks for me. That was his job. But no, that was the old Apollo's way of thinking. The Apollo I'd been the last time I was in this apartment. Percy was entitled to his own life. He was trying to have one, and, oh, the bitter truth, it had nothing to do with me. "I'm happy for him," I said, "and Annabeth." Then it occurred to me that they'd probably been incommunicado since they left New York. Cell phones attracted too much monstrous attention for demigods to use, especially on a road trip. Magical means of communications were slowly coming back online since we'd released the god of silence, Harpocrates, but they were still spotty. Percy and Annabeth might have no idea about all the tragedies we'd faced on the West Coast, at Camp Jupiter, and before that in Santa Barbara. "Oh dear," I muttered to myself. "I suppose that means they haven't heard." Meg coughed loudly. She gave me a hard, "shut up" glare. Right. It would be cruel to burden Sally and Paul with news of Jason Grace's death, especially when Percy and Annabeth were making their way to California, and Sally must already be worried about them. "Haven't heard what?" Sally asked. I swallowed dryly. "That we were coming back to New York. No matter. We'll just..."
"Enough small talk," Lou interrupted. "We are in grave danger. These mortals cannot help us. We must go."
Lou's tone wasn't exactly disdainful, just irritated. And maybe concerned for our hosts. If Nero tracked us to this apartment, he wouldn't spare Percy's family just because they weren't demigods. On the other hand, the Arrow of Dodona had told us to come here. There had to be a reason. I hoped it had something to do with what Paul was cooking. Sally studied our large, tattooed friend. She didn't look offended, more like she was taking Lou's measure and pondering whether she had any clothes large enough to fit her. "Well, you can't leave dripping wet. Let's get you some dry things to wear, at least, and some food if you're hungry." "Yes, please," Meg said. "I love you." Estelle burst into a fresh peal of giggles. She had apparently just discovered that her father's fingers could wiggle, and she considered this hilarious. Sally smiled at her baby, then at Meg.
"I love you too, dear.
Percy's friends are always welcome."
"I have no idea who this Percy is," Lou protested.
"Anyone who needs help is always welcome," Sally amended. "Believe me, we've been in danger before, and we've come through it. Right, Paul?"
"Yep," he agreed without hesitation. "There's plenty of food. I think Percy has some clothes that will fit, is it Apollo?"
I nodded morosely. I knew all too well that Percy's clothes would fit me, because I'd left here 6 months ago wearing his hand-me-downs. "Thank you, Paul," Lou grunted.
"I suppose, is that lasagna I smell?"
Paul grinned.
"The Blowfish family recipe."
"Hmm, I suppose we could stay for a bit," Lou decided.
The wonders never ceased. The Gaul and I actually agreed on something.
"Here, try this."
Paul tossed me a faded Percy t-shirt to go with my ratty Percy jeans. I did not complain. The clothes were clean, warm, and dry. And after trudging underground across half of Manhattan, my old outfit smelled so bad it would have to be sealed in a hazardous waste pouch and incinerated. I sat on Percy's bed next to Estelle, who lay on her back, staring in fascination at a blue plastic donut. I ran my hand across the faded words on the t-shirt. AHS Swim Team. What does AHS stand for?
Paul wrinkled his nose. Alternative High School. It was the only place that would take Percy for just his senior year after, you know. I remembered.
Percy had disappeared for the entirety of his junior year thanks to the meddling of Hera, who zapped him across the country and gave him amnesia, all for the sake of making the Greek and Roman demigod camps unite for the war with Gia. My stepmother just loved bringing people together. You didn't approve of the situation? Or the school? I asked. Paul shrugged. He looked uncomfortable, as if saying anything negative would go against his nature. Estelle gave me a drooling grin.
Gah?
I took this to mean, can you believe how lucky we are to be alive right now? Paul sat next to her and gently cupped his hand over her wispy hair.
I'm an English teacher at another high school, he said. AHS was not the best. For kids who are struggling, at risk, you want a safe place with good accommodations and excellent support. You want to understand each student as an individual. Alt High was more like a holding pen for everybody who didn't fit into the system. Percy had been through so much, I was worried about him. But he made the best of the situation. He really wanted to get that diploma. I'm proud of him. Estelle cooed. Paul's eyes wrinkled around the edges. He tapped her nose. Boop. The baby was stunned for a millisecond. Then she laughed with such glee I worried she might choke on her own spit. I found myself staring in amazement at Paul and Estelle, who struck me as even greater miracles than Percy's graduation. Paul seemed like a caring husband, a loving father, a kind stepfather. In my own experience, such a creature was harder to find than an albino unicorn or three-winged griffin. As for baby Estelle, her good nature and sense of wonder rose to the level of superpowers. If this child grew up to be as perceptive and charismatic as she appeared to be now, she would rule the world. I decided not to tell Zeus about her. Paul, I ventured, aren't you worried about having us here? We might endanger your family. The corners of his mouth tightened. I was at the Battle of Manhattan. I've heard about some of the horrible things Sally went through. Fighting the Minotaur, being imprisoned in the underworld, and Percy's adventures. He shook his head in respect. Percy has put himself on the line for us, for his friends, for the world plenty of times. So can I risk giving you a place to catch your breath, some fresh clothes, and a hot meal? Yeah. How could I not? You are a good man, Paul Blofus. He tilted his head as if wondering what other kind of man anyone would possibly try to be. Well, I'll leave you to get cleaned up and dressed. We don't want dinner to get burned, do we, Estelle? The baby went into a fit of giggles as her father scooped her up and carried her out of the room. I took my time in the shower. I needed a good scrubbing, yes. But mostly I needed to stand with my forehead against the tiles, shaking and weeping until I felt like I could face other people again. What was it about kindness? In my time as Lester Papadopoulos, I had learned to stand up under horrendous verbal abuse and constant life-threatening violence. But the smallest act of generosity could ninja kick me right in the heart and break me into a blubbering mess of emotions. Darn you, Paul and Sally, and your cute baby too. How could I repay them for providing me this temporary refuge? I felt like I owed them the same thing I owed Camp Jupiter and Camp Half-Blood. The way station and the cistern, Piper and Frank and Hazel and Leo and yes, especially Jason and Grace. I owed them everything. How could I not? Once I was dressed, I staggered out to the dining area. Everyone was seated around the table except Estelle, who Paul informed me was down for the night.
No doubt all that pure joy required a great amount of energy. Meg wore a new pink smock dress and white leggings. If she cherished these as much as the last outfit Sally had given her, she would end up wearing them until they fell off her body in burned and shredded rags. Together with her red high tops, which thankfully had been well cleaned, she sported a Valentine's Day color theme that seemed quite out of character. Unless you considered her sweetheart to be the mountain of garlic bread she was shoveling into her mouth. Lou was dressed in an XXL men's work shirt with Electronics Megamart stitched over the pocket. She wore a fluffy turquoise towel around her waist like a kilt, because she informed me the only other pants in the apartment large enough to fit her were Sally's old maternity pants, and no thank you, Lou would just wait for hers to get out of the dryer. Sally and Paul provided us with heaping plates of salad, lasagna, and garlic bread. It wasn't Sally's famous seven-layer dip, but it was a family-style feast like I hadn't experienced since the weigh station. That memory gave me a twinge of melancholy. I wondered how everyone there was doing. Leo, Calypso, Emmy, Joe, little Georgina. At the time, our trials in Indianapolis had felt like a nightmare. But in retrospect, they seemed like happier, simpler days. Sally Jackson sat down and smiled. "Well, this is nice." Shockingly, she sounded sincere. "We don't have guests often. Now, let's eat. And you can tell us who or what is trying to kill you this time."
5. No swearing at the table?
Then don't talk about
that bleep, bleep Nero.
I wished we could have had regular small talk around the dinner table. The weather. Who liked whom at school? Which gods were casting plagues on which cities and why? But no.
It was always about who was trying to kill me.
I didn't want to ruin anyone's appetite, especially since Paul's savory family recipe lasagna was making me drool like Estelle. Also, I wasn't sure I trusted Lugus Elwa enough to share our whole story. Meg had no such qualms. She opened up about everything we'd been through, with the exception of the tragic deaths. I was sure she only skipped those to spare Sally and Paul from worrying too much about Percy. I don't think I'd ever heard Meg talk as much as she did at Sally and Paul's dinner table, as if the presence of kindly parental figures had uncorked something inside her. Meg told them about our battles with Commodus and Caligula. She explained how we had freed 4 ancient oracles and had now returned to New York to face the last and most powerful emperor, Nero. Paul and Sally listened intently, interrupting only to express concern or sympathy. When Sally looked at me and said, "You poor dear," I almost lost it again. I wanted to cry on her shoulder. I wanted Paul to dress me in a yellow onesie and rock me until I fell asleep.
"So, Nero is after you," Paul said at last. "The Nero? A Roman emperor has set up his evil lair in a midtown high-rise." He sat back and placed his hands on the table, as if trying to digest the news along with the meal. "I guess that's not the craziest thing I've ever heard. And now you have to do what? Defeat him in combat? Another Battle of Manhattan?" I shuddered. "I hope not. The battle with Commodus and Caligula was hard for Camp Jupiter. If I asked Camp Half-Blood to attack Nero's base..."
"No."
Lou dipped her garlic bread in her salad dressing, proving her barbarian bona fides.
"A large-scale assault would be suicide. Nero is expecting one. He's hoping for one. He's prepared to cause massive collateral damage."
Outside, rain lashed the windows. Lightning boomed, as if Zeus were warning me not to get too comfortable with these kindly surrogate parents. As much as I distrusted Lugus Elwa, I believed what she said. Nero would relish a fight.
despite what had happened to his two compadres in the Bay Area, or maybe because of it. I was afraid to ask what Lou meant by massive collateral damage. An all-out war with Nero would not be another Battle of Manhattan. When Cronus's army had stormed the Empire State Building, entrance to Mount Olympus, the Titan Morpheus had put all the mortals in the city to sleep. The damage to the city itself and its human population had been negligible. Nero didn't work that way. He liked drama. He would welcome chaos, screaming crowds, countless civilian deaths. This was a man who burned people alive to illuminate his garden parties. There has to be another way, I decided. I won't let any more innocents suffer on my account. Sally Jackson crossed her arms. In spite of the grim matters we were discussing, she smiled. You've grown up. I assumed she was talking about Meg. Over the last few months, my young friend had indeed gotten taller and... Wait, was Sally referring to me? My first thought, preposterous. I was 4,000 years old. I didn't grow up. She reached across the table and squeezed my hand. The last time you were here, you were so lost. So, well, if you don't mind me saying. Pathetic? I blurted out. Whiny, entitled, selfish. I felt terribly sorry for myself. Meg nodded along with my words, as if listening to her favorite song. You still feel sorry for yourself. But now, Sally said, sitting back again, you're more human, I suppose. There was that word again. Human. Which, not long ago, I would have considered a terrible insult. Now, every time I heard it, I thought of Jason Grace's admonition. Remember what it's like to be human. He hadn't meant all the terrible things about being human, of which there were plenty. He'd meant the best things. Standing up for a just cause, putting others first, having stubborn faith that you could make a difference, even if it meant you had to die to protect your friends and what you believed in. These were not the kind of feelings that gods had, well, ever. Sally Jackson meant the term in the same way Jason had, as something worth aspiring to. Thank you, I managed. She nodded. So how can we help? Lou slurped the last of the lasagna from her plate. You've done more than enough, Jackson mother and Blofus father. We must go. Meg glanced out the window at the thunderstorm, then at the remaining garlic bread in the basket. Maybe we could stay until the morning?
That's a good idea, Paul agreed. We have plenty of space. If Nero's men are out there searching for you in the dark and the lashing rain, wouldn't you rather they be out there while you're in here, warm and comfortable?
Lou seemed to consider this. She belched long and deep, which in her culture was probably a sign of appreciation, or a sign that she had gas.
Your words are sensible, Blofus father. Your lasagna is good.
Very well. I suppose the cameras will see us better in the morning anyway.
Cameras? I sat up. As in Nero's surveillance cameras. I thought we don't want to be seen.
Lou shrugged. I have a plan.
A plan like the one on the train? Because...
Listen here, small Lester.
Hold it,
Paul ordered. His voice was calm but firm, giving me an inkling as to how this kind, gentle man could control a classroom.
Let's not argue. We'll wake Estelle. I guess I should have asked this before, but,
He glanced between Meg, me, and Lou.
How exactly do you know each other?
Lou held us hostage on a train, I said.
I saved you from capture on a train, she corrected.
Lou's my guardian, Meg said. That got everyone's attention. Sally raised her eyebrows. Lou's ears turned bright red. Paul's face remained in teacher mode. I could imagine him asking Meg to elaborate on her statement, to provide three examples in a well-argued paragraph.
Guardian in what sense, Meg? He asked.
Lou glanced at the girl. The gall had a strange look of hurt in her eyes as she waited for Meg to describe their relationship. Meg pushed her fork across her plate.
Legally. Like if I needed somebody to sign stuff, or pick me up from the police station or whatever.
The more I thought about this, the less absurd it seemed. Nero wouldn't bother with the technicalities of parenthood. Signing a permission slip, taking Meg to the doctor, no thanks. He would delegate such things. And legal status? Nero didn't care about formal guardianship. In his mind, he owned Meg.
Lou taught me swords.
Meg squirmed in her new pink dress.
She taught me, well, most stuff. When I lived in the palace, Nero's tower, Lou tried to help me. She was the nice one.
I studied the giant gall in her electronics Megamart shirt and her bath towel kilt. I could think of many descriptions for her. Nice wasn't the first one that sprang to mind. However, I could imagine her being nicer than Nero. That was a low bar. And I could imagine Nero using Lou as his proxy, giving Meg another authority figure to look up to. A woman warrior. After dealing with Nero and his terrifying alternate personality, the Beast, Meg would have seen Lou as a welcome relief. You were the good cop, I guessed. Lou's neck veins bulged against her golden torque.
Call me what you like. I didn't do enough for my sapling, but I did what I could. She and I trained together for years.
Sapling? Paul asked.
Oh, right, because Meg's a daughter of Demeter.
His expression remained serious, but his eyes twinkled, like he couldn't believe he was lucky enough to be having this conversation. I didn't feel quite as fortunate. I was gripping my fork so tightly my fist trembled. The gesture might have looked threatening if the tines hadn't been topped with a cherry tomato. You were Meg's legal guardian, I glared at Lou. You could have taken her out of that tower. You could have relocated, run with her, but you stayed. For years.
Hey,
Meg warned.
No, he's right.
Lou's eyes bored a hole in the casserole dish.
I owed Nero my life. Back in the old times, he spared me from... Well, it doesn't matter now. But I served him for centuries. I've done many hard things for him. Then the sapling came along. I did my best. Wasn't enough. Then Meg ran away with you. I heard what Nero was planning. What would happen when you two came back to the city? She shook her head. It was too much. I couldn't bring Meg back to that tower.
You followed your conscience, Sally said. I wished I could be as forgiving as our hostess. Nero doesn't hire warriors for their consciences. The big woman scowled.
That's true, little Lester. Believe me or don't, but if we can't work together, if you don't listen to me, then Nero will win. He'll destroy all of this.
She gestured around the room. Whether she meant the world, Manhattan, or the Jackson Blowfist apartment, any of those possibilities was unacceptable.
I believe you, Sally announced.
It seemed ridiculous that a huge warrior like Lou would care about Sally Jackson's approval, but the Gaul looked genuinely relieved. Her facial muscles relaxed. The elongated Celtic tattoos on her arms settled back into concentric circles.
Thank you, Jackson Mother.
I believe you too.
Meg frowned at me, her meaning clear.
and so will you, or I'll order you to run into a wall.
I set down my tomato-topped fork. It was the best gesture of peace I could offer. I couldn't make myself trust Lugu Selwa completely. A good cop was still a cop. Still a part of the mind game. And Nira was an expert at playing with people's heads. I glanced at Paul, hoping for support, but he gave me an almost imperceptible shrug.
What else can you do?
Very well, Lugu Selwa, I said. Tell us your plan.
Paul and Sally leaned forward, ready for marching orders. Lou shook her head.
Not you, my good hosts. I have no doubt you are brave and strong, but I will not see any harm come to this family.
I nodded. On that, at least, we agree. Once the morning comes, we're out of here. Possibly after a good breakfast, if it's not too much trouble.
Sally smiled, though there was a tinge of disappointment in her eyes, as if she'd been looking forward to busting some evil Roman heads. I still want to hear the plan. What will you do?
Best to not share too many details, Lou said. But there is a secret way into Nero's tower, from below. It is the way that Nero takes to visit the reptile.
Coils of lasagna seemed to tighten in my stomach. The reptile. Python. Interloper at Delphi, my arch nemesis and winner of Olympus Magazine's Least Popular Serpent Award for 4,000 years running. That sounds like a terrible way in, I noted.
It is not wonderful, Lou agreed.
But we can use it to sneak in, Meg guessed. Surprise Nero?
Lou snorted.
Nothing so easy, sapling. The way is secret, but it is still heavily guarded and under constant surveillance. If you try to sneak in, you would be caught.
I'm sorry, I said. I'm still not hearing anything resembling a plan. Lou took a moment to gather her patience. I was familiar with this look. I had gotten it from Meg and my sister Artemis and, well, everyone, actually.
The way is not for you, she said. But it could be used to sneak in a small squad of demigods. If any were brave enough and sufficiently skilled at navigating underground.
Son of Hades, I thought, the Amphis Bina's words echoing in my head. Cavern runner's friend. Must show the secret way unto the throne. The only thing more unsettling than not understanding a prophecy was beginning to understand it. Then they would just get captured, I said.
Not necessarily, Lou said. Not if Nero were sufficiently distracted.
I had a feeling I was not going to like the answer to my next question. Distracted by what?
Your surrender, Lou said.
I waited.
Lou did not seem the type for practical jokes, but this would have been a good moment for her to laugh and yell, "Not!"
You can't be serious, I said. I'm with Apollo, Sally said. If Nero wants to kill him, why would he?
It's the only way.
Lou took a deep breath.
Listen, I know how Nero thinks. When I return to him and tell him you two got away, he will issue an ultimatum.
Paul frowned. To whom?
Camp Half-Blood, Lou said. Any demigods, any allies anywhere who are harboring Apollo. Nero's terms will be simple. Apollo and Meg surrender themselves within a certain amount of time, or Nero destroys New York.
I wanted to laugh. It seemed impossible. Ridiculous. Then I remembered Caligula's yachts in San Francisco Bay, launching a barrage of Greek fire projectiles that would have destroyed the entire East Bay if Lavinia Asimov hadn't sabotaged them. Nero would have at least as many resources at his disposal, and Manhattan was a much more densely populated target.
Would he burn his own city? With his own palatial tower in the middle of it? Dumb question, Apollo. Nero had done it before. Just ask ancient Rome. So you rescued us, I said, just to tell us we should surrender to Nero.
That's your plan.
Nero must believe he has already won, Lou said. Once he has you two in his grasp, he will relax his guard.
This may give your demigod team a chance to infiltrate the tower from below.
May,
I echoed.
The timing will be tricky, Lou admitted. But Nero will keep you alive for a while, Apollo. He and the reptile, they have plans for you.
A distant thunderclap shook my chair.
Either that or I was trembling.
I could imagine what sort of plans Nero and Python might have for me. None of them included a nice lasagna dinner.
And Sapling, Lou continued. I know it will be hard for you, going back to that place. But I will be there to protect you, as I've done many times before. I will be your inside woman. When your friends invade, I can free you both. Then, together, we can take down the Emperor.
Why did Meg look so pensive? As if she were actually considering this insane strategy?
Just a minute, I protested. Even if we trust you, why would Nero? You say you'll go back to him with your tail between your legs and report that we got away. Why would he believe that? Why won't he suspect you've turned on him?
I have a plan for that too, Lou said. It involves you pushing me off a building.
6. Bye, Luguselwa. Don't forget to ride if you ever hit the ground. I'd heard worse plans. But while the idea of pushing Lou off a building had a certain appeal, I was skeptical that she really meant it. Especially since she wouldn't explain further or offer us details.
Tomorrow, she insisted, once we're on our way.
The next morning, Sally made us breakfast. Estelle giggled at us hysterically. Paul apologized for not having a car to lend us, since the family Prius, which we usually crashed, was on its way to California with Percy, Grover, and Annabeth. The best Paul could offer us was a subway pass. But I wasn't ready to ride any more trains. Sally gave us all hugs and wished us well. Then she said she had to get back to baking cookies, which she did to relieve stress while she was working on the revisions for her second novel. This raised many questions for me.
Second novel?
We hadn't discussed her writing at all the night before. Cookies? Could we wait until they were done? But I suspected that good food was a never-ending temptation here at the Jackson Blofus home. There would always be a next sweet or savory snack that was more appealing than facing the harsh world. Also, I respected the fact that Sally needed to work. As a god of poetry, I understood revisions. Facing monsters and imperial mercenaries was much easier. At least the rain had stopped, leaving us a steamy June morning. Lou, Meg, and I headed toward the East River on foot, ducking from alley to alley until Lou found a location that seemed to satisfy her. Just off First Avenue, a 10-story apartment building was in the process of a gut renovation. Its brick facade was a hollow shell, its windows empty frames. We sneaked through the alley behind the lot, climbed over a chain-link construction fence, and found the back entrance blocked only by a sheet of plywood. Lou broke through it with one sturdy kick.
After you, she said.
I eyed the dark doorway. We really have to go through with this?
I'm the one who has to fall off the roof, she muttered. Stop complaining.
The building's interior was reinforced with metal scaffolding, rung ladders leading from one level to the next. Oh, good. After climbing Sutro Tower, I just loved the idea of more ladders.
Rays of sunlight sliced through the structure's hollow interior, swirling up dust clouds and miniature rainbows. Above us, the roof was still intact. From the topmost tier of scaffolding, a final ladder led up to a landing with a metal door. Lou began to climb. She had changed back into her Amtrak disguise so she wouldn't have to explain the electronics Megamart shirt to Nero. I followed in my Percy Jackson hand-me-downs. My funny Valentine Meg brought up the rear. Just like old times at Sutro Tower, except with 100% less Reina Avila Ramirez Arellano, and 100% more tattooed Gaul. On each level, Meg stopped to sneeze and wipe her nose. Lou did her best to stay away from the windows, as if worried that Nero might burst through one and yell, "Boare!" I'm pretty sure that was Latin for boo. It's been a while since I attended one of Cicero's famous haunted house parties. That man did love to put a toga over his head and scare his guests. Finally, we reached the metal door, which had been spray-painted with a red stenciled warning, roof access restricted. I was sweaty and out of breath. Lou seemed unperturbed by the climb. Meg kicked absently at the nearest brick, as if wondering whether she could collapse the building.
"Here's the plan," Lou said. "I know for a fact Nero has cameras in the office building across the street. It's one of his properties. When we burst out this door, his surveillance team should get some good footage of us on the roof."
"Remind us why that's a good thing?" I asked. Lou muttered something under her breath, perhaps a prayer for her Celtic gods to smack me upside the head.
"Because we're going to let Nero see what we want him to see. We're going to put on a show."
Meg nodded.
"Like on the train."
"Exactly," Lou said.
"You two run out first. I'll follow a few steps behind. Like I've finally cornered you and I'm ready to kill you."
"In a strictly play-acting way," I hoped.
"It has to look real," Lou said.
"We can do it."
Meg turned to me with a look of pride.
"You saw us on the train, Lester, and that was with no planning. When I lived at the tower, Lou would help me fake these incredible battles so Father, Nero, I mean, would think I killed my opponents."
I stared at her.
"Kill your opponents? Like servants or prisoners or just people he didn't like. Lou and I would work it out beforehand. I'd pretend to kill them, fake blood and everything. Then after, Lou would drag them out of the arena and let them go. The deaths look so real. Nero never caught on." I couldn't decide what I found most horrifying. Meg's uncomfortable slip calling Nero father, or the fact that Nero had expected his young stepdaughter to execute prisoners for his amusement, or the fact that Lou had conspired to make the show non-lethal to spare Meg's feelings rather than, oh, I don't know, refusing to do Nero's dirty work in the first place and getting Meg out of that house of horrors.
"And are you any better?" taunted a small voice in my brain. "How many times have you stood up to Zeus?"
"Okay, small voice. Fair point. Tyrants are not easy to oppose or walk away from, especially when you depend on them for everything." I swallowed the bitter taste in my mouth. "What's my role?"
"Meg and I will do most of the fighting."
Lou hefted her crossbow.
"Apollo, you stumble around and cower in fear."
"I can do that."
"Then, when it looks like I'm about to kill Meg, you scream and charge me. You have bursts of godly strength from time to time, I've heard."
"I can't summon one on command."
"You don't have to. Pretend. Push me as hard as you can, right off the roof. I'll let you do it."
I looked over the scaffold railing.
"We're 10 stories up. I know this because we're 10 stories up."
"Yes," Lou agreed. "Should be about right. I don't die easily, little Lester. I'll break some bones, no doubt. But with luck, I'll survive.
With luck?
Meg suddenly didn't sound so confident. Lou summoned a scimitar into her free hand.
We have to risk it, Sapling. Nero has to believe I did my very best to catch you. If he suspects something, well, we can't have that.
She faced me.
Ready?
No, I said. You still haven't explained how Nero intends to burn down the city or what we're supposed to do once we get captured.
Lou's fiery look was quite convincing. I actually believed she wanted to kill me.
He has Greek fire. More than Caligula did. More than anyone else has ever dared to stockpile. He has some delivery system in place. I don't know the details. But as soon as he suspects something is wrong, one push of a button, and it's all over. That's why we have to go through this elaborate charade. We have to get you inside without him realizing it's a trick.
I was trembling again. I stared down at the concrete floor and imagined it disintegrating, dropping into a sea of green flame. So what happens when we're captured?
The holding cells, Lou said. They're very close to the vault where Nero keeps his fasces.
My spirits rose at least a millimeter. This wasn't good news exactly, but at least Lou's plan now seemed a little less insane. The Emperor's fasces, the golden axe that symbolized his power, would be connected to Nero's life force. In San Francisco, we destroyed the fasci of Commodus and Caligula, and weakened the Emperors just enough to kill them. If we could do the same to Nero. So you break us out of our cells, I guessed, and lead us to this vault.
That's the idea.
Lou's expression turned grim.
Of course, the fasces is guarded by, well, something terrible.
What?
Meg asked. Lou's hesitation scared me worse than any monster she might have named.
Let's deal with that later. One impossible thing at a time.
Yet again, I found myself agreeing with the Gaul. This worried me.
Okay then, she said. Lester, after you push me off the roof, you and Meg get to Camp Half-Blood as fast as you can. Find a demigod team to infiltrate the tunnels. Nero's people won't be far behind you.
But we don't have a car.
Huh. Almost forgot.
Lou glanced down at her belt, as if she wanted to grab something, then realized her hands were full of weapons.
Sapling, reach into my pouch.
Meg opened the small leather bag. She gasped at whatever she saw inside, then pulled it out tightly clutched in her hand, not letting me see.
Really?
She bounced up and down with excitement.
I get to?
Lou chuckled.
Why not? Special occasion.
Yay!
Meg slipped whatever it was into one of her gardening pouches. I felt like I'd missed something important. What?
Enough chat, Lou said. Ready? Run!
I was not ready, but I'd gotten used to being told to run. My body reacted for me, and Meg and I burst through the door. We scrambled over the silver tar surface, dodging air vents and stumbling on loose bricks. I got into my role with depressing ease. Running for my life? Terrified and helpless? Over the last 6 months, I'd rehearsed that plenty. Lou bellowed and charged after us. Twin crossbow bolts whistled past my ear. She was really selling the whole murderous Gaul thing. My heart leaped into my throat as if I were actually in mortal danger. Too quickly, I reached the edge of the roof. Nothing but a waist-high lip of brick separated me from a 100-foot drop into the alley below. I turned and screamed as Lou's blade slashed toward my face. I arched backward, not fast enough. Her blade sliced a thin line across my forehead. Meg materialized, screaming with rage. She blocked the Gaul's next strike and forced her to turn. Lu dropped her crossbow and summoned her second blade, and the two Dimekairai went at it in a full-bore dramatic interpretation of Kung Fu Cuisinarts. I stumbled, too stunned to feel pain. I wondered why warm rain was trickling into my eyes. Then I wiped it away, looked at my fingers, and realized, nope, that's not rain. Rain wasn't usually bright red. Meg's swords flashed, driving the big Gaul back. Lu kicked her in the gut and sent her reeling. My thoughts were sluggish, pushing through a syrupy haze of shock. But I seemed to remember I had a role in this drama. What was I supposed to do after the running and the cowering? Oh, yes. I was supposed to throw Lu off the roof. A giggle bubbled up in my lungs. I couldn't see with the blood in my eyes. My hands and feet felt like water balloons, wobbly and warm and about to burst. But sure, no problem. I would just throw a huge dual sword wielding warrior off the roof. I staggered forward. Lu thrust with her left blade, stabbing Meg in the thigh. Meg yelped and stumbled, crossing her swords just in time to catch Lu's next strike, which would have cleaved her head in two. Wait a second. This fight couldn't be an act. Pure rage lit the Gaul's eyes. Lu had deceived us. And Meg was in real danger. Fury swelled inside me. A flood of heat burned away the haze and filled me with godly power. I bellowed like one of Poseidon's sacred bulls at the altar, and let me tell you, those bulls did not go gently to the slaughter. I barreled toward Lugaselwa, who turned wide-eyed, but had no time to defend herself. I tackled her around the waist, lifted her over my head as easily as if she were a medicine ball, and tossed her off the side of the building. I overdid it. Rather than dropping into the alley, she sailed over the rooftops of the next block and disappeared. A half second later, a distant metallic clunk echoed from the canyon of First Avenue, followed by the angry weep, weep, weep of a car alarm. My strength evaporated. I wobbled and fell to my knees, blood trickling down my face. Meg stumbled over to me. Her new white leggings were soaked through from the wound on her thigh. "Your head," she murmured. "I know. Your leg." She fumbled through her gardening pouches until she found two rolls of gauze. We did our best to mummify each other and stop the bleeding. Meg's fingers trembled. Tears welled in her eyes. "I'm sorry," I told her. "I didn't mean to throw Lu so far. I thought she was really trying to kill you." Meg peered in the direction of First Avenue. "It's fine. She's tough. She's probably fine. But no time to talk. Come on." She grabbed my waist and pulled me up. We somehow made it back inside, then managed to navigate the scaffolds and ladders to get out of the hollow apartment building. As we limped to the nearest intersection, my heartbeat flumped irregularly, like a trout on the floorboards of a boat. Ugh, I had Poseidon on the brain now. I imagined a caravan of shiny black SUVs full of Germani roaring toward us, encircling our location to take us into custody. If Nero had indeed seen what had happened on that rooftop, it was only a matter of time. We'd given him quite a show. He would want our autographs, followed by our heads on a silver plate. At the corner of 81st and 1st, I scanned the traffic. No sign of Germani yet. No monsters. No police or civilians screaming that they just witnessed a Gaulish warrior fall from the sky. "What now?" I asked, really hoping Meg had an answer. From her belt pouches, Meg fished out the item Lu had given her. A shiny golden Roman coin. Despite everything we'd just been through, I detected a gleam of excitement in my young friend's eyes.
"Now I summon a ride," she said.
With a cold flush of dread, I understood what she was talking about. I realized why Lugu Selwa had given her that coin, and part of me wished I had thrown the gall a few more blocks.
"Oh no," I pleaded. "You can't mean them. Not them."
"They're great,"
Meg insisted. "No, they are not great. They're awful."
"Maybe don't tell them that,"
Meg said. Then she threw the coin into the street and yelled in Latin,
"Stop, O chariot of damnation!"
7. Chariot of damnation. Why stoppest thou here? I don't use your app. Call me superstitious. If you're going to hail a chariot, you should at least try for one that doesn't have damnation right there in the name. Meg's coin hit the pavement and disappeared in a flash. Instantly, a car-sized section of asphalt liquefied into a boiling pool of blood and tar. At least, that's what it looked like. I did not test the ingredients. A taxi erupted from the goo like a submarine breaking the surface. It was similar to a standard New York cab, but gray instead of yellow. The color of dust, or tombstones, or probably my face at that moment. Painted across the door were the words, "Gray Sisters." Inside, sitting shoulder to shoulder across the driver's bench, were the three old hags, excuse me, the three mature female siblings, themselves. The passenger side window rolled down. The sister riding shotgun stuck out her head and croaked,
"Passage! Passage!"
She was just as lovely as I remembered. A face like a rubber Halloween mask, sunken craters where her eyes should have been, and a cobweb and linen shawl over her bristly white hair. "Hello, Tempest," I sighed. "It's been a while." She tilted her head.
"Who's that? Don't recognize your voice. Passage or not, we have other fares."
"It is I said miserably. "The god Apollo." Tempest sniffed the air. She smacked her lips, running her tongue over her single yellow tooth.
"Don't sound like Apollo. Don't smell like Apollo. Let me bite you."
No, I said. "You'll have to take my word for it. We need..."
"Wait."
Meg looked at me in wonder. "You know the Gray Sisters?" She said this as if I'd been holding out on her. As if I knew all three founding members of Bananarama and had not yet gotten Meg their autographs. My history with Bananarama, how I introduced them to the actual Venus and inspired their number one hit cover of that song, is a story for another time. "Yes, Meg," I said. "I am a god. I know people." Tempest grunted.
"Don't smell like a god,"
she yelled at the sister on her left.
"Wasp, take a gander. Who is this guy?"
The middle sister shoved her way to the window. She looked almost exactly like Tempest. To tell them apart, you'd have to have known them for a few millennia, which, unfortunately, I had. But today she had the trio's single communal eye, a slimy, milky orb that peered at me from the depths of her left socket. As unhappy as I was to see her again, I was even more unhappy that, by process of elimination, the third sister, Anger, had to be driving the taxi. Having Anger behind the wheel was never a good thing.
"It's some mortal boy with a blood-soaked bandana on his head,"
Wasp pronounced after ogling me.
"Not interesting. Not a god."
"That's just hurtful," I said.
It is me, Apollo. Meg threw her hands up.
Does it matter? I paid a coin. Can we get in, please?
You might think Meg had a point. Why did I want to reveal myself? The thing was, the Gray Sisters would not take regular mortals in their cab. Also, given my history with them, I thought it best to be upfront about my identity, rather than have the Gray Sisters find out halfway through the ride and chuck me out of a moving vehicle.
Ladies,
I said, using the term loosely. I may not look like Apollo, but I assure you it's me. Trapped in this mortal body, otherwise, how could I know so much about you?
Like what?
Demanded Tempest.
Your favorite nectar flavor is caramel creme, I said.
Your favorite beetle is Ringo. For centuries, all three of you had a massive crush on Ganymede, but now you like...
He's Apollo!
Wasp yelped.
Definitely Apollo,
Tempest wailed.
Annoying! Knows things!
Let me in, I said, and I'll shut up. That wasn't an offer I usually made. The back door lock popped up. I held the door open for Meg. She grinned.
Who do they like now?
I mouthed, tell you later. Inside, we strapped ourselves in with black chain seatbelts. The bench was about as comfortable as a beanbag stuffed with silverware. Behind the wheel, the third sister, Anger, grumbled,
Where to?
I said, Kemp. Anger hit the gas. My head slammed into the backrest, and Manhattan blurred into a light-speed smear. I hoped Anger understood I meant Camp Half-Blood, or we might end up at Camp Jupiter, Camp David, or Campabella, New Brunswick. Though I suspected those were outside the Gray Sisters' regular service area. The cab's TV monitor flickered to life. An orchestra and a studio audience laugh track blared from the speaker. Every night at 11, the announcer said, It's Late Night with Thalia! I mashed the off button as fast as I could.
I like the commercials, Meg complained.
They'll rot your brain, I said. In truth, Late Night with Thalia had once been my favorite show. Thalia, the muse of comedy, not my demigod comrade Thalia Grace, had invited me on dozens of times as the featured musical guest. I'd sat on her sofa, traded jokes with her, played her silly games like Smite That City and Prank Call Prophecy. But now I didn't want any more reminders of my former divine life.
Not that I missed it. I was...
Yes, I'm going to say it. I was embarrassed by the things I used to consider important. Ratings, worshippers, the rise and fall of civilizations that liked me best. What were these things compared to keeping my friends safe? New York could not burn. Little Estelle Blofus had to grow up free to giggle and dominate the planet. Nero had to pay. I could not have gotten my face nearly chopped off that morning and thrown Lugaselwa into a parked car two blocks away for nothing. Meg appeared unfazed by my dark mood and her own wounded leg. Deprived of commercials, she sat back and watched the blur of landscape out the window. The East River, then Queens, zipping by at a speed that mortal commuters could only dream of. Which, to be fair, was anything above 10 miles an hour. Anger steered completely blind, as Wasp occasionally called out course corrections.
Left! Break! Left! Now the other left!
So cool, Meg said. I love this cab. I frowned. Have you taken the Gray Sisters' cab often? My tone was the same as one might say, You enjoy homework.
It was a special treat, Meg said. When Lou decided I'd trained really well, we'd go for rides.
I tried to wrap my mind around the concept of this mode of transportation as a treat. Truly, the Emperor's household was a twisted, evil place.
The girl has taste,
Wasp cried.
We are the best way around the New York area. Don't trust those ride-sharing services. Most of them are run by unlicensed harpies.
Harpies,
Tempest howled.
Stealing our business,
Anger agreed. I had a momentary vision of our friend Ella behind the wheel of a car. It made me almost glad to be in this taxi. Almost.
We've upgraded our service, too,
Tempest boasted. I forced myself to focus on her single milky eye. How?
You can use our app, she said. You don't have to summon us with gold coins anymore.
She pointed to a sign on the plexiglass partition. Apparently, I could now link my favorite magical weapon to their cab and pay via virtual drachma using something called Gray Ride. I shuddered to think what the Arrow of Dodona might do if I allowed it to make online purchases. If I ever got back to Olympus, I'd find my accounts frozen and my palace in foreclosure because the Arrow had bought every known copy of Shakespeare's First Folio. Cash is fine, I said. Wasp grumbled to Anger.
You and your predictions. I told you the app was a stupid idea. Stopping for Apollo was stupider, she muttered back. That was your prediction. You're both stupid,
snapped Tempest.
That's my prediction.
The reasons for my long-standing dislike of the Gray Sisters were starting to come back to me. It wasn't just that they were ugly, rude, gross, and smelled of grave rot, or that the three of them shared one eye, one tooth, and zero social skills. It wasn't even the awful job they did hiding their celebrity crushes. In ancient Greek days, they'd had a crush on me, which was uncomfortable, but at least understandable. Then, if you can believe it, they got over me. For the past few centuries, they'd been in the Ganymede fan club. Their Instagod posts about how hot he was got so annoying. I finally had to leave a snarky comment. You know that meme with the honey bear and the caption, "Honey, he gay?" Yes, I created that. And in Ganymede's case, it was hardly news. These days, they'd decided to have a collective crush on Deimos, the god of fear, which just made no romantic sense to me. Sure, he's buff and he has nice eyes, but... Wait, what was I talking about again? Oh, right. The biggest friction between the Gray Sisters and me was professional jealousy. I was a god of prophecy. The Gray Sisters told the future too, but they weren't under my corporate umbrella. They paid me no tributes, no royalties, nothing. They got their wisdom from... Actually, I didn't know. Rumor had it they were born of the primal sea gods, created from swirls of foam and scum. So they knew little bits of wisdom and prophecy that got swept up in the tides. Whatever the case, I didn't like them poaching my territory. And for some inexplicable reason, they didn't like me back. Their predictions. Hold on. I did a mental rewind. Did you say something about predicting you would pick me up?
Ha! Tempest said. Wouldn't you like to know?
Anger cackled.
As if we would share that bit of doggerel we have for you. Shut up, Anger.
Wasp slapped her sister.
He didn't ask yet.
Meg perked up.
You have a dog for Apollo?
I cursed under my breath. I saw where this conversation was going. The three sisters love to play coy with their auguries. They like to make their passengers beg and plead to find out what they knew about the future. But really, the old gray dingbats were dying to share. In the past, every time I'd agreed to listen to their so-called prophetic poetry, it turned out to be a prediction of what I would have for lunch, or an expert opinion about which Olympian god I most resembled. Hint, it was never Apollo. Then they would pester me for a critique and ask if I would share their poetry with my literary agent. Ugh. I wasn't sure what tidbits they might have for me this time, but I was not going to give them the satisfaction of asking. I already had enough actual prophetic verse to worry about. Doggerel, I explained for Meg's sake, means a few irregular lines of poetry. With these three, that's redundant, since everything they do is irregular.
We won't tell you then,
Wasp threatened.
We will never tell,
Anger agreed. I didn't ask, I said blandly.
I want to hear about the dog,
Meg said. No, you don't, I assured her. Outside, Queens blurred into the Long Island suburbs. In the front seat, the Gray sisters practically quivered with eagerness to spill what they knew.
Very important words, Wasp said.
But you'll never hear them.
Okay, I agreed.
You can't make us,
Tempest said,
even though your fate depends on it.
A hint of doubt crept into my cranium. Was it possible? No, surely not. If I fell for their tricks, I'd most likely get the Gray Sisters' hot take on which facial products were perfect for my skin undertones. Not buying it, I said.
Not selling,
Wasp shrieked.
Too important, these lines. We would only tell you if you threatened us with terrible things.
I will not resort to threatening you.
He's threatening us!
Tempest flailed. She slammed Wasp on the back